Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hi everyone, this is your host, John Hagedorn, and this is 1001 Radio Days. Today's show, This Is Your FBI, was a radio crime drama which aired in the United States on ABC from April 6, 1945 to January 30, 1953, for a total of 409 shows. In other words, it did real well. The show featured true cases from the FBI and told it from an agent's viewpoint. FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover gave it his endorsement, considering it our show, and calling it the finest dramatic program on the air. The shows would involve everything from crackdowns on organized crime to stories of individual lawbreakers. Some were well-known crimes being worked on during that time period. The agents handled cases involving fraud, petty crime, and professional crooks, as well as clearing those falsely accused. It gives you a good insight as to what the FBI was doing 70 years ago. A great history lesson, if you will. And now, This Is Your FBI.
This is your FBI. This is your FBI, an official broadcast from the files of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, presented as a public service by the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States. To your FBI, you look for national security, and to the Equitable Society for financial security. These two great institutions are dedicated to the protection of you, your home, and your country. Tonight, the story of a crime against our nation. Espionage.
That year, the continent of Europe already echoed the cries of people under aggression. On the continent of Asia, far beyond our western shores, was Japan. A dedicated nation, a dedicated people, dedicated to war upon the United States. But we did not know this yet. Within our western gates were more Japs, thousands of them. Were they dedicated to being good American citizens, or were there among them some dedicated to our destruction? Here was a vital task for the FBI. The safety and security of America might depend on what they found out. A Sunday afternoon in 1939, two FBI agents from the San Francisco office stood on a pier at the San Francisco waterfront watching a Japanese cruiser warp into the dock.
How big would you figure that crowd, Jim?
Oh, I'd say, at least 1,000.
Pretty excited for Japs, aren't they?
Well, this is a big day for them, Larry. It isn't often they get a chance to pay their respects to a big shot from Japan.
I know.
Larry, is this Prince Tsuji a member of the royal family?
Yes.
They sure are giving him the Sunday bows, all right.
Funny how they conform to that caste system of theirs. That first line that shook hands with the prince were all top bracket boys.
I know, I've checked them off. Japanese consul general, head of the Jap Association, leaders of the prefectural groups. Second line was a middle bracket bunch, bankers, nip businessmen.
All they got from the good prince was a nod.
Well, that's more than the small fry are getting now. Those housewives and farmers.
They bow, and the prince doesn't even acknowledge their presence. Say. Look at that bull-necked little man in the chauffeur's uniform.
What about him?
You notice something? He's not cringing or bowing. He's standing in line with his head up and shoulders back like a soldier.
Oh, yes.
Hey, did you see that?
Yes.
The prince bowed to him.
I know.
I don't like that, Jim. They don't play it that way in their league. Princes don't go around bowing to chauffeurs.
Unless our chauffeur is a big shot back in Japan.
Yes. That's something you and I better check on.
One Jap bowing to another Jap. A pair of striped pants and cutaway coat bowing to a chauffeur's uniform. The two FBI agents, troubled by what they saw, investigated and learned the chauffeur's name and background. Then they took their information to the agent in charge of the San Francisco office of the FBI.
That's the story, Mr. Walker.
A prince bowing to a chauffeur. That is unusual.
Yes.
Did you follow this man?
Yes, sir. He lives at the Osaka Hotel.
His name?
Yasu Kajioka.
Did you learn anything about his work?
Yes, he drives a big Cadillac. He owns it. He runs some sort of escort service with headquarters at the hotel.
Anything else on him?
We found out that he's been a very active worker for many of the local Japanese associations.
Well, I think we should do a thorough check on Mr. Kajioka's activities.
Won't be too easy. We could use some help.
From whom?
Someone of his own race. A Japanese who is loyal to us.
Well, we might try the university. They have quite a few Japanese-American students there.
That's a good idea.
Suppose I arrange with the dean of studies out there for you to have a talk with him.
Fine.
I'll get him on the phone right now.
The two FBI agents spent almost an entire day with the dean of studies of the university. They pored over the personal records of many Japanese-American students and finally narrowed down their choice to one man, a student by the name of Tom Tanaka. His record showed he lived in the same neighborhood as the Jap chauffeur.
Gentlemen, have you reached a decision?
Yes, sir. This man, Tom Tanaka, looks good to us.
Well, I think you've made an excellent choice.
He lives in the same neighborhood as the man we want watched. If he measures up in other ways, that's a definite plus.
I understand.
You realize, sir, how important it is to us that we be able to trust this boy implicitly?
Yes, I do.
We've got to know if he's loyal, if he's a real American at heart, if he thinks and acts like an American.
There are thousands of men and women who live here on the West Coast, Mr. Schuyler, who look Japanese and are the sons and daughters of Japanese. But I know them as true Americans. They're as loyal as any of us whose ancestors were German, English, French, Irish, or whatever. I say that this boy is an American, just as you or I.
Good. Can we meet him at once?
Tom, I imagine your dean has told you that we're special agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Yes, sir. He has.
We've selected you, son, from the list of the entire enrollment of Japanese Americans here at the university.
As a student?
No. No, as an American.
Well, what about it? I am an American.
We believe you are, in every sense of the word.
Has somebody been talking about me?
No. No.
Then what's this all about, sir?
Tom, we want you to help us.
How?
In a very important, perhaps very dangerous way.
You want me to work with the FBI?
Yes.
Do you know a man called Kajioka? Yasu Kajioka?
Why, yes, we're neighbors. I helped him compose letters in English several times.
Good. Well, do you remember you?
I think so. He said once that he might give me a job doing secretarial work in my spare time. Why do you ask me about Kajioka?
We need a loyal Japanese-American like yourself to help us investigate this man. We want to know if he is connected with any un-American activities.
What do you want me to do?
Help us to get information. Tom, all we want are facts.
I see.
You said that you know Kajioka, that he offered you a job once. We want you to go to him. Take the job.
We're giving you the opportunity to do this as an American, Tom.
Well, what would I say to Kajioka? How would I ask for the job?
You'd tell him that you're in need of money to finish your studies. If he hired you, you'd undertake at once to impress him with your love of Japan and the Japanese.
We don't want you to put your life in danger. You'd be cautious, never inquisitive.
What do you say, son?
I'll do it.
Thank you.
No. What do you want, young man?
I want to talk to you, Mr. Kajioka.
What about, please?
A job.
Why?
To earn some money.
Why do you come to me, lowly chauffeur, if you need money?
You told me someday you might give me a job.
Oh, yes. Why you want to earn money?
To keep up my studies.
You got father, mother.
I don't want to ask them.
So, but you ask lowly chauffeur. Why?
Everyone says good things of Kajioka.
Oh, good. You hear perhaps I visit cruiser.
They say Kajioka was greatly honored.
Oh, so, they say correctly. Please, you sit down.
Thank you.
Now, how you think?
What do you mean?
It could be important for me to know.
I think Japanese.
Oh, so. And what are those thoughts, please?
I love my people. I love Japan.
So, I think maybe you lie.
Why should I? Who can read my thoughts?
Oh, very, very good. Yes.
Will you give me a job?
Yes. You work for me now. Come every day. I'll try to read your thoughts. Very good. Very good. Yes.
Once the all-important inside contact had been made, many FBI agents took up the trail. They learned that Kajioka always drove Japs who were easily identified as high-ranking naval officers on vacation. They learned that he was the head of a secret Jap organization on the West Coast, the Hamusha Kai, boasting over 10,000 members, all eligible for military service in Japan. The society masked itself as a charitable one. Charity in the sense that thousands and thousands of dollars were drafted from the members and sent back to Japan. Why? The answer came quickly and dramatically. One night, on a street corner, young Tom Tanaka reported to the special agents of the FBI.
Tom. Tom.
Yes, sir.
Here we are.
I haven't much time, sir. I've got to get back.
What have you got, sir?
Something big is cooking. There's a great meeting called in the basement of the Japanese high school for tonight. Kajioka will make an appeal to get more funds to send back to Japan.
I see.
Also, they are to show preparedness movies sent over from Japan.
Are you supposed to attend this meeting?
Yes. Kajioka will expect it.
Tom.
Yes, sir.
We need a list of the members in that organization. Practically everything depends on our getting it. Do you think you could go to the meeting, get the list, and get away alive?
Yes. The pictures may go on about 8 o'clock. I'll try and sneak out and meet you here then.
Good boy.
Good luck. We'll be waiting.
We momentarily close the Federal Bureau of Investigation file on Kajioka, enemy alien. We will reopen this file in just a moment. Yesterday, Thomas I. Parkinson, president of the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States, received an interesting letter. It was from a member of the Equitable Society, and it read, "Mr. Parkinson, just how many businesses is the Equitable Society in, anyway? Our radio program talks about millions of Equitable dollars invested in war bonds, and more millions in key war industries like shipyards and railroads, in oil, steel, and aluminum. Friends tell me how the Equitable Society helps keep kids in school and helps people own their own homes and farms. It all sounds mighty complex to me. Yes, investing the premium dollars of 3,200,000 members of the Equitable Society is of necessity a very complicated operation. For safety's sake, those equitable funds have to be spread out widely, must go into thousands of different enterprises. And yet all this is done to make it easy and simple for Equitable Society members to attain greater security for themselves and their loved ones. And so you see, by employing its funds in all kinds of activities that are useful to the nation as a whole, the Equitable Society is able to offer sounder and safer protection to its members
than any one member could achieve by his own unaided efforts. By serving its members, the Equitable Society serves America. And now, back to the file on Kajioka, Enemy Alien.
In that year, there wasn't even a slight buzzing in our ears to warn us that enemy planes were warming up for an attack. There was nothing in the word protocol to make us think of anything but where the wife of some ambassador might have to sit at some state dinner. Yet two men of the FBI standing on a dock at San Francisco had seen in a bit of Jap protocol enough to make their blood run cold. Enough to make them, on their own initiative as Americans, set up a series of patient, exhaustive, dangerous investigations which inched down 1939 through 1940 and brought them on the evening of February 3rd, 1941 to stand tense in a darkened hallway near a high school in the Jap section of San Francisco.
Watch it, Jim. Don't let that street light hit you.
I've counted about 2,000 and gone into that meeting so far.
Still coming. Kajioka sure must have passed the word along. What time is it?
Almost 7:45. Mm-hmm.
Looks like the meeting is getting started.
Somebody coming along to see the channel.
Pull back here.
It's Tom.
Tom, here.
Oh, hello. We've got a wonderful break. Kajioka forgot to bring the records. He wants me to go to his house and get them and bring them to the meeting.
What part of the meeting is on now?
They're going to run off the movies.
How long will that take?
Until about 9:15.
Good. I'll go with you. Get the records. Bring them to the FBI office. We'll have them photographed and back in your hands by 9 o'clock.
Can you do it that soon?
We got to. Jim.
Yes?
You stay here. Call the office. Tell them what we have to do. Ask for the entire staff to stand by.
Right.
I'll drive Tom over.
It's going to be tight going.
I know. But this is the first break we've gotten, and it may be the only one. Let's go.
While the movies whip the Japanese audience up with blatant pictures of Japan's armed might, while distinguished visitors sat rigidly straight in the front rows, their cropped heads marking them high officers of the Emperor's Army and Navy, while almost 3,000 sons of Nippon shared a new sense of oneness, of dedication to Emperor and country, an alerted FBI office, brilliant with lights, crowded with 100% staff, worked feverishly to photograph the secret documents and make the deadline.
I don't think we can wait any longer, Mr. Logan. It's 8:54.
I know.
I've got to be back to the hall before the lights are turned up.
We'll make it.
1 minute to deadline. How are you coming?
Two more sheets.
The others are finished.
Come on, then. Hurry it up.
Please, you've got to give me the originals. I can't wait. The movie ends at 9:15.
Let's start correlating pages in the original. You know how they go, Tom?
Yes, sir.
I'll grab them as fast as they're finished.
Number two is finished. Come on, snap up on number three machine.
Please, hurry.
Hold an elevator.
Right.
Here you are. This is the final.
Thanks. We'll put them together in the car.
It's 8:55.
Let's go. We'll just make it.
Mr. Kajioka.
Where have you been? It took you a long time to get papers.
I stood in the back of the hall to see the pictures. I thrilled with the people.
Give me the records.
Here you are, sir.
Good. I have news. We have received orders to change names of all branch chapters of our organization, and we must at once seem to stop our activities.
Why?
Why? Because soon, glorious Japan will win honor or downfall, and we are ordered to prepare for duty as soldiers behind the guns.
The FBI had everything it needed now on Brother Kajioka. His position as head of the secret society. His activity as a chauffeur deluxe for visiting Japanese officers. His role as collector extraordinary of funds for the Japanese war machine. His devious role as espionage agent. Everything the FBI needed except the right to go out and arrest him. Under our way of government, we do not go about arresting citizens of friendly nations. The FBI could watch and wait. And to add insult to injury, while it fretted over its watching and waiting, One of the FBI agents had reason to phone in to the agent in charge of the San Francisco Bureau.
Yes?
This is Logan.
Yes, Larry.
Jim and I have been following Kajioka.
Yes?
We followed him from the Osaka Hotel. He drove straight to Sutter Street.
Yeah?
Parked his car, proceeded on foot to 111 Sutter Street.
Why, well, that's our building here.
I know.
Well, where did Kajioka go?
He's in your foyer, waiting to see you.
He's what? Well, thanks, Larry. Goodbye. Yes?
Mr. Kajioka to see you, sir.
Send Mr. Kajioka right in.
Mr. Walker?
Yes. What can I do for you?
I am Kajioka.
Sit down, Kajioka. Now, what do you want to see me about?
I come to FBI because I am honorable man.
I see.
I wish to offer my services to the United States.
Why?
I hate Japanese.
Oh? Tell me about it.
I was born in Japan. One time in Japan, they arrested my father. He was a good man, harmed nobody. They say he was disloyal, but they have no proof, and it is a lie.
What happened to him?
I never see him again. They murder my father.
And so you hate Japanese?
Oh, yes, very much. I would be good agent for FBI.
What makes you think so?
Japanese government tried to get me to work against United States. You know how it is. You have information on certain secret Japanese organizations here. No?
A little.
Oh, that is too bad. With me, you get to know much. I know all Japanese tricks. I make valuable agent.
Perhaps you would, Mr. Kajioka.
You think about it. And remember, I want to work for United States. Great country. I work for FBI and kill many Japs.
Well, we're not interested in killing Japs nor anyone else.
Sometime it will be necessary. Then you tell Kajioka what to do, where to go, and he goes.
Well, thank you very much for your offer, Mr. Kajioka. We'll take it under consideration and we'll let you know in due time.
Thank you so much.
Not at all. It will be a pleasure.
Mr. Kajioka might have smelled a rat. That is, if a rat can smell himself. But his surprising offer was politely refused, and his intensified wanderings by day and night were as equally matched by the more intensified watching by the many electricians and workmen, laundrymen, truck drivers, cabmen, innocent motorists, who sent in their reports under the names of special agents of the FBI. Still, all they could do was watch. Watch and follow the little man who is dedicated, like his country, to the destruction of America. Then came December 7th, 1941. On that fateful day, the entire staff of the FBI was gathered in tense silence in each of the Bureau's offices. In San Francisco, even the local law enforcement officers were present, waiting. Waiting.
Everyone here?
Everyone, sir.
Larry, you and Jim can stand by and watch the teletype.
Right, sir.
The names are coming in from Washington. Names and addresses of enemy aliens to be picked up when the word comes through.
We'll take them.
I know a name you two will want to watch for.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
We're getting into the K's now?
Yeah.
Hello? Yes, sir. Right. That's the word. Get going.
K is in Kajioka. K is in Kajioka. Come on, teletype.
There it is. Capital K for Kajioka, the little rat. We got him now. Come on.
Otto, now you see who I am. Major Kajioka. Yes. How do I look in my uniform, Pop?
Very well, sir.
No more lowly chauffeur. Glorious Japan has struck. American fleet, no more. Pearl Harbor, no more. All gone.
soon planes come, then transport.
Yes.
I have two revolvers, see? Oiled and loaded. I give you one. Soon our soldiers march in the streets, and you and I will go out and kill every dirty American we see. Yes?
Yes.
Yes. You watch at the window. Tell me when you see planes. Tell me when you see glorious soldiers of our brave army. I will pour drink for ceremonial toast.
Yes, sir. I'll keep watch.
Soon I will be colonel. Then general. Wait until you see how they will reward me for what I've done. I will be big man.
Yes, of course.
I hear planes. Do you see them yet?
Not yet.
Listen, our soldiers are coming. I drink to glorious Japan. They are here. Come in. Banzai!
Come on, Kajioka.
Huh?
Uncle Sam wants to see you about a place called Pearl Harbor.
Kajioka was rounded up with thousands of his kind. Rounded up with the aid of a loyal Japanese American. Like the rest, Kajioka wondered how the FBI had known of his work. Does he remember that little incident back in 1939 when a pair of striped pants and a cutaway coat bowed to a chauffeur's uniform on the hard deck of a Japanese cruiser? Probably not. He wouldn't understand the things that make Americans tick. The American willingness of those who serve our country in the ranks of the FBI. No, Kajioka probably will never understand until it's too late. And how will he ever know that it was too late that day back in 1939?
You'll hear about the disposition of this case in just a minute. On the beaches of Normandy, our boys were seeing the latest movies 24 hours after landing. And not long ago on a Pacific island, two Japanese snipers were captured when they tried to join a GI audience to see an American film. Yes, movies follow the flag because Uncle Sam knows that they're first-rate morale builders for battle-weary men. So will you join the Equitable Society in a salute to the motion picture industry? A salute to the daring cameramen who risk their lives in every American attack. To the technical men who developed special equipment to photograph Tokyo from 45,000 feet in the air. To the actors, musicians, and directors who made tens of thousands of valuable training films for our armed forces. And to the 16,000 theater managers who have sold millions of war bonds in every drive. Members of the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States will be proud to learn that their premium dollars have helped finance this great industry, which has proved such a vital asset to the nation at war. For years, the Equitable Society has invested in the motion picture industry, as well as in other essential American industries and American agriculture. Yes, in wartime, Equitable Society dollars are fighting dollars. And at all times, they are security dollars for you, your home, and your country.
As an enemy alien, Yasu Kajioka was placed in an internment camp to remain there for the duration of the war with Japan.
The incidents used in tonight's broadcast are taken from the files of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. However, all names used are fictitious, and any similarity thereof to the names of persons living or dead is accidental. Programs in this series of particular interest to servicemen and women are broadcast overseas through the worldwide facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Tonight, Kajioka was played by Ted Osborne. The music was under the direction of Van Cleve. The author was Frank Wilson, and your narrator was Frank Lovejoy.
This Is Your FBI is a Jerry Devine production. Now, this is Carl Frank speaking for the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States and inviting you to tune in again next week at this same time for This Is Your FBI. And now the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States brings you a message from the Office of War Information. It may seem slightly ridiculous these hot July days to be thinking of winter heating problems. But actually, it's the most sensible thing you can do. The fuel situation is still critical, so don't put off your heating problems and forget all about them. Check your heating equipment now. Order insulation for the walls, windows, and doors of your home. Talk with your fuel dealer and take his advice. Fill your coal bin or your oil tank right away before the fall rush begins. This is the American Broadcasting Company. This is your FBI. This is your FBI, an official broadcast from the files of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, presented as a public service by the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States. To your FBI, you look for national security, and to the Equitable Society for financial security. These two great institutions are dedicated to the protection of you, your home, and your country. Tonight, the story of a crime against the people. Misery chiseling.
Crawling on one of the lower rungs of the criminal scale is the breed known as the misery chiseler. Defined in dignified terms, he is one who preys on the misfortunes of another for profit. In language more becoming him, he is a parasite who exists on human sorrow, heartache, and misery. The war, with its backwash of heartaches here at home, has given the misery chiseler a rich field in which to work. Through the cooperation of the victims, however, the FBI has already bagged scores of these despicable criminals and is continuously warring against them. But a misery chiseler is not too easily caught, because he has robbed his victim and disappeared before the victim realizes or even suspects that he or she has been robbed. The story of tonight's case begins in San Francisco, in the modest little home of Mrs. Henry Miller, a widow, whose son was reported missing in action some time ago. But just now, from a man introducing himself as Colonel Addison Bramley of British Army Intelligence, Mrs. Miller has heard good news.
You don't know how I've prayed, Colonel Bramley, that this might be true.
I understand.
That my son was alive, even though a prisoner of the Japanese.
Yes, it is much better to know that than nothing at all.
I know.
Well, I fear, madam, I must be dashing along now.
Oh, must you leave right away, Colonel Bramley?
Yes, I must. I have so little time, sorry to say.
Oh.
I'm en route to Washington on a special mission in connection with the work of the underground in Indochina, you see.
Oh, of course. Well, you'll never know how deeply grateful I am to you.
Not at all, madam. One is never too busy to perform an errand of mercy. Let us both rather be grateful to your good pastor, Reverend Morley, for bringing us together.
Oh, he's been so kind trying to get some news for me.
It was just luck, you know.
Really?
Somewhere en route from Burma, I mislaid the slip of paper with your son's name. But thank heavens I did recall that you're both members of the Hillside Church here. So I made him...
Family.
Yes?
I'd hate to bother you, but could you get a letter to my son through the underground?
I believe so, yes.
I'd be so grateful.
I have a suggestion.
Yes?
With a little money, Mrs. Miller, your son could purchase special favors and comforts from the Japanese guards. They're very susceptible to petty bribery.
Could you get that to him, too?
Well, we have managed from time to time to transmit sums of money from parents to their sons.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. I haven't much, but, well, I have $500 in my savings account. Could you get that to my son?
Certainly. And I can assure you, madam, that such a sum would improve your boy's circumstances immeasurably.
Then I'll go to the bank the first thing in the morning. Oh, but that'd be too late for you.
No, no, not at all. My plane for Washington doesn't leave until 11 a.m. I could meet you in the lobby of my hotel just before going to the airfield.
Oh, thank you, Colonel Bradley.
My dear madam, it's been a pleasure.
You can understand Mrs. Miller's readiness to give this perfect stranger $500. Outweighing her normal caution was her anxiety for her son. And Colonel Bramley, so called, his important bearing and credible story, and the fact that he had contacted her through her pastor, these things were enough to allay any suspicion. And no doubt her disillusionment would have been delayed for a long time had not something occurred a few days later, which brought her to the San Francisco office of the FBI.
And what caused you to suspect this Colonel Bramley, Mrs. Miller?
This message, Mr. Hartley, from the War Department.
Oh, I see.
There had been a mistake. My son was not missing. He was wounded, and they're sending him home.
That's fine.
I'll not tell him anything about it, of course.
But we're mighty glad that you told us.
A neighbor of mine said that I should.
You've done exactly right. These things are embarrassing to the victims, I know. But unless they report the cases, we don't know that they exist.
I only hope I haven't come too late.
You've given us an excellent description of the man, and we'll go to work at once.
Do you have to say anything to my pastor? He'd feel so badly about it.
He'll be as anxious for us to catch this man as you and we are, I'm sure.
Of course, but...
And he might have a helpful clue. We'll teletype this description to Washington headquarters at once.
During the next few hours, every hotel, every airline, railroad, and bus ticket office in San Francisco was checked by FBI agents. But no trace of any Colonel Bramley or anyone fitting Mrs. Miller's general description of him. Later that evening, a teletype message is coming into the FBI office as Special Agent Hartley enters.
What's coming in, John?
Answer from Washington. They say, no information on Colonel Bramley or anyone fitting general description in personal files. Try to get fingerprints.
Well, I did just that, and I got them.
You did? Where?
I think our Colonel Bramley made a mistake calling on Mrs. Miller's pastor.
What do you mean?
The pastor had Bramley sign his guest book.
Huh?
Look. Bramley signed on the right-hand page and had to press down the left-hand page with his left fingers while he signed. Reverend Morley saw him do it.
Well, he certainly left some fingerprints.
Yes. They were going to send these specimens off to Washington right away.
Ironically enough, while his fingerprints and handwriting are speeding across the continent, Colonel Bramley, a few hundred miles away in Salt Lake City, is just complimenting his young hostess on an excellent dinner. On this occasion, however, he has demoted himself to a Major Romney Richards.
My dear madam, that was a most delightful meal.
Well, it was very simple, really, Major Richards.
Oh, come now. I haven't dined so well in quite a spell. A bit of a rhyme, what?
And pure flattery. And you know it.
Oh, nonsense. I'm quite shamelessly a philogastric, an ardent epicurean, and I declare I envy your good husband such an excellent cook.
Well, Major, this was all too little in return for what you're going to do for him.
I must repeat, nonsense.
I don't know how I can ever thank you enough for either of us.
Just thank your good pastor, my dear, for bringing us together. And you may rest assured that through my agents in Russia, working with the Manchurian underground, the money will reach and bring relief to your dear husband.
Another day, another city, and another victim. And still free to pursue his loathsome profession. But in San Francisco, he had left a trace,
and in both cities he had left a pattern of operation. Therefore, although unaware of it, his race against time had begun. For the moment, the advantage was his because the FBI had not yet established his identity. But an hour later, as he boarded a bus out of Salt Lake City to continue his misery-chiseling trek eastward, the teletype brought a report to the FBI San Francisco office.
Got something for you, Hartley.
What is it?
Report from Washington. They identified those prints.
Good.
It says, Bramley fingerprints identified with swindler whose description tallies with description furnished by Mrs. Miller.
Here, let me see.
Here you are.
Your man is Thomas Edward Bradley, born Chicago, Illinois. 40 years old, 5 feet 11, 175 pounds. Served New York prison term, forgery. Paroled on request of chaplain whom Bradley served as secretary.
That explains the minister angle in his operations.
Exactly. I'll get it. Hello? Yes? Salt Lake office calling. Hello? Yes, Hartley speaking. Oh, hello, Jager. What? Yes. Yes. That's enough for me. Teletype your report to Washington. Goodbye.
What's up?
Mr. Bradley pulled a job in Salt Lake City last night. I'm going there in the next plane.
We momentarily close the Federal Bureau of Investigation file on Thomas Bradley, Misery Chiseler. We will reopen this file in just a moment. In the office of President Thomas I. Parkinson of the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States is a folder filled with letters that come straight from the heart of America. These letters were written by the fathers and mothers and wives of Equitable Society members who have died while serving with the armed forces of the United States. Since the Equitable is truly a society in which all policyholders belong to one big family, we would like to share the inspiration of these letters with all our members. And here, for example, is one from a father who has given us permission to read it on this program. He writes, Dear Mr. Parkinson, your kind letter of sympathy made us feel more like living and carrying on. As from the way it was written, I know the words came direct from your heart. It's very easy to see how a society like yours could achieve so much. It couldn't be otherwise. Your consoling letter would make our son proud to know that he belonged to a society like yours. The principles for which he fought and gave his life make us proud to be the parents of a son like him. While he was called upon to make the supreme sacrifice, we know now that he did not give his life in vain. Letters like these keep us continually conscious of our responsibility to members of the Equitable Society and to all America. And now, back to the file on Thomas Bradley, Misery Chiseler.
Unfortunately, a misery chiseler nearly always leaves a large number of victims in his wake. But the more promptly the victims report their cases, the shorter becomes the criminal's trail. Mrs. Miller in San Francisco did not report her case for 3 days, although she was not to blame for that. But this gave the criminal, Thomas Edward Bradley, a 3-day start. The FBI lost another day establishing his identity. And a 4-day start in an area as broad as America is quite a handicap in pursuing a criminal who must keep on the move. The FBI now had Bradley's description and his pattern of operation. And all FBI field offices throughout the country had been alerted. His race against the FBI and time had begun in earnest, and already he had lost ground. The report of the fresh case in Salt Lake City had cut Bradley's lead from 4 days to 36 hours. At this moment, Special Agent Hartley, bent on picking up Bradley's trail, has landed in a passenger plane on Salt Lake City's airport.
Hartley?
Oh, hello, Jager.
Not much use in you stopping off here.
What's the story?
When Washington alerted us this afternoon, we contacted all ministers.
Yes?
One of them reported a Major Richards. He had sent him to a Mrs. Warner. Her story is in this report here.
What about Bradley?
We checked, and he left on a bus at 9:30 last night for Denver.
He's loose in Denver by now, I guess.
Yes. We got the information too late to have him picked up at the Denver terminal.
But the Denver office is working on the case.
Yes.
All ministers there alerted?
Yes. And all railroad and bus offices are being watched.
Good. Thanks, Jager. I'm heading for Denver.
Special Agent Hartley arrived in Denver about 4 a.m. The FBI agents there had uncovered no trace of Bradley. But he had to be somewhere in the city. Hotels and rooming houses were checked. No Bradley. And by that afternoon, no minister had reported any contact with him. But Bradley was at work that afternoon, just the same.
What a glorious drive this is, Mrs. Curtis.
I never tire of it, Colonel Ashley.
I dare say you couldn't. If it weren't for this beastly war and the work I must do, I should love to tarry in the midst of this scenic splendor for a season myself.
You must come back someday.
You may be sure I shall. But for now, I'm afraid we must be turning back toward the city.
Oh. Colonel Ashley.
Yes.
How soon will the money reach my son?
The underground in occupied China is doing a splendid job, Mrs. Curtis. Your son should receive the money within a fortnight.
The criminal who lives by his wits is smart enough to alter his pattern of operation occasionally. That's why no minister in Denver had been contacted by Bradley. With the aid of newspaper files, he had contacted a next of kin directly. That's why also Bradley was not apprehended leaving Denver. It was 2 days later when the FBI uncovered the fact that Bradley had boarded an eastbound bus 2 stations out of Denver and had reached his destination by now, Cleveland. But 5 hours later, by plane, Special Agent Hartley arrived in Cleveland, too. It is shortly after noon, and Hartley is just entering the FBI office.
Hello, Phil.
Oh, come in, Hartley. We've been expecting you.
What's been happening?
The town's pretty well covered, but no lead on Bradley yet.
You read his report?
Yes.
I hope he goes back to the minister pattern here.
The ministers have all been alerted, but no report from any yet.
How about the newspaper list of next of kin for the boys missing in action?
3 men are working on it, but Bradley may go to work before all next of kin are alerted.
Yes.
You figure he worked that way in Denver?
Well, he didn't contact any ministers, and the newspaper files are open to anybody.
So Bradley went down the list of missing in action, picked out a victim, and went to work.
I'm sure of it.
Well, we've covered everything. We'll just have to wait for developments.
Yes, but I sure hope they develop, and fast.
It is now 7 p.m., and nothing is developed for the FBI. But at this moment, in a Cleveland suburb, a Mrs. Paul Everett's front doorbell rings.
Mrs. Everett?
Yes?
I'm Major Radcliffe, British Army Intelligence.
Oh, yes. Reverend Matthew's housekeeper phoned that you were coming over. Well, won't you come in?
Thank you. Thank you. Mrs. Everett, I have news for you.
Oh?
About your husband.
About Paul,
your
but he...
husband, Mrs. Everett, is alive.
Oh.
And I've come to ask you if there is any...
Reverend Matthew's housekeeper sent Bradley to Mrs. Everett's house. But why wasn't the FBI notified? While Bradley goes to work on his prospective victim, the minutes, the hours drag by in the FBI office.
Well, Phil, it doesn't look like things are going to develop.
No.
Bradley is going into action here. We should have heard by now.
I know. I'll get it. Robert speaking.
This is Reverend Matthews.
Yes, Reverend?
I was out all afternoon and neglected to tell my housekeeper about your warning.
Yes?
I have just returned, and she tells me she directed a Major Radcliffe to Mrs. Paul Everett's house.
Yes?
He's probably still there.
What's the address?
1625 Lenway Boulevard.
Lenway Boulevard. Thank you very much, Reverend.
One of the ministers, Phil?
Yes. Here's her name and address. A Mrs. Paul Everett. I think Bradley's there.
Good. I'll get a cab. You phone the woman and tell her to hold Bradley.
Right.
Wait for me, driver.
Right.
How do you do?
Yes.
I'm Special Agent Hartley, FBI.
Oh, yes, I've been expecting you.
Is the Major still here?
No, I'm sorry. He left just a few minutes before your office called.
Another miss, but this time by a margin of only a few minutes. This meant Bradley was still in Cleveland. If he tried to register at a hotel or a trenchant rooming house, clerks were keeping a sharp lookout for a man of his description with a British accent. If he tried to leave the city, airline, bus, and railroad ticket offices were alerted by the FBI, all waiting for Bradley to make a move. 4 hours passed and no report. Then Special Agent Hartley began a personal round of travel officers. It was 1 a.m. when he reached an airline ticket office. He scanned the brief list of passengers booked on the flights, then questioned the girl on duty.
Dr. Philip Gibson. Remember him?
Yes, he said he was a surgeon here.
I've looked in the telephone directory, and there's no Dr. Philip Gibson listed.
There's not?
No. How old a man was he?
Oh, around 40.
British accent?
I don't remember.
Notice anything particular about him?
Well, no, but he did make a mistake. He asked for space to Newark, New Jersey, and we don't stop there anymore.
Newark, eh?
Yes. I gave him space to New York and told him how to take the tube to Newark.
When did his flight leave?
Oh, it's reached New York by now.
Yeah, use your phone.
Why, yes, of course.
Thanks. Would you book me on the next flight to New York, miss?
Yes, sir. That will be about an hour from now.
Hello? Phil? Hartley. Contact the Newark office right away to set the stage for Bradley and have them alert ministers and all next of kin. I'm on the next plane to New York.
Hartley arrived at the Newark office of the FBI about 6 a.m. By noon, the stage was set. Ministers alerted. Next of kin of boys missing in action alerted. Everything was in readiness. The afternoon hours dragged by. Nothing happened. 6 o'clock. Maybe there was a Dr. Philip Gibson after all. Maybe Bradley hadn't dropped his English accent, changed his name and manner. 7 o'clock. 7:30. At 8 o'clock, a Mrs. George Wiley, a resident of Newark, was entertaining a guest in her living room.
Some more tea, Colonel Barton?
No, thank you. It was delicious, but I can't name the blend for the life of me.
Oh, gracious, I wouldn't know either. To me, tea is tea, except in a Chinese restaurant.
A jolly good quip, that. Well, Mrs. Wiley, I'm afraid I really must be dashing off. You'll be late for your dinner engagement.
But it's been such a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. And I find it difficult to leave your charming company, but I have urgent matters to take care of in New York this evening.
Of course.
And you may rest assured that as soon as I've cashed your check, the money will be on its way to your brother. The Korean underground has not failed yet.
I can't thank you enough, Colonel.
Just thank Providence for making it possible for me to be of service to you. Good night, Mrs. Wiley.
Good night, Colonel.
Oh, just a minute, please.
I beg your pardon?
You should. For making me chase you all the way from San Francisco.
What the devil are you talking about, sir, and just who are you?
I'm a special agent of the FBI.
The FBI?
That's right.
I'd like to ask you some questions.
Look here, young man. Do you know to whom you're speaking?
Yes, I do, Mr. Bradley.
Bradley?
Yes. Thomas Edward Bradley. Bad check artist, forger, swindler, and misery chiseler.
Heaven!
Wanted for impersonating an officer of a country with whom the United States is at peace.
Gad, man, is that true?
It is.
Then I trust the FBI will exhibit proper regard for this country's international relations and take such an utter scoundrel out of circulation.
And so, thanks to the cooperation of the citizens on whom he preyed, the FBI was able to chalk up another victory in its war on the misery chiseler. Bradley's final capture was made possible in this case when Mrs. George Wiley, who had been alerted, took long enough at making a pot of tea to also telephone the FBI. Scores of Bradley's kind have been arrested, but not all. Their arrest depends on your help. And you can make their miserable racket unprofitable by dealing only through government agencies and through reputable public service organizations in seeking information concerning loved ones in the service reported missing. Also, by checking first with the FBI before dealing with any individual professing to have special knowledge about the missing person. Remember, the FBI belongs to you. It operates for your protection.
For you, your home, and your country.
Thomas Bradley, charged with impersonating an accredited official of a country with which the United States is at peace, was sentenced to a long term in a federal penitentiary.
I hope you enjoyed This Is Your FBI. If you did, please send us a review or send us a Spotify comment. We appreciate both. Until next time, everyone, take care, and we'll be back soon.